This is the Integrate Intelligently podcast from Catatalk Software. A podcast about the people, programs, and processes that come together to make businesses successful. At Catatalk, we're a software integration company, but we believe this idea of intelligent integration goes much deeper than software.
Hi, I'm Jeff Brickler, accompanied by Scott Brickler and Kevin Miller. So welcome back to the episode 22 of the Integrate Intelligently podcast. Today, we have another guest, a welcome guest, longtime colleague, Kevin Miller. Hey, Kevin, nice to have you here. Scott, of course, always great to have you here as well.
Hey, everybody. Good to see you.
So, Kevin, I know, you and I have been working together for a few years. You're with IFS. You're the CTO, Chief Technology Officer at IFS. That's a bit of a different title than I think maybe what your role typically is. So could you give a brief overview of like what you do at IFS and how long you've been there and that sort of thing?
Yeah. How long do we have? Just kidding.
So you're right, Jeff. So the Chief Technology Officer for the North American region at IFS, really what that means is that, you know, I'm the chief technical face of IFS in front of prospective customers and customers. So I have the wonderful opportunity to talk about our tech story, but also how customers are using and adopting IFS across the six main targets that we service, which of course are very asset intensive industries that work with heavy assets across the board, whether they're designing, manufacturing, deploying, servicing, or maintaining an asset of any kind. That's where IFS plays well. But sort of under the umbrella, if you will, of the CTO office, I have pre-sales teams, which are both functional, technical, as well as value engineering, bid management, and items like that. We really want to manage that early life cycle experience with prospective customers in terms of not just our tech stack, but the outcomes that we want to provide those customers and those companies looking at IFS. And so really all those pre-sale oriented groups are what roll under the umbrella of CTO.
So Kevin, I think, you know, we don't get to see each other too much, but we recently were in Orlando, Florida at the IFS Unleashed event. Tell us a little bit about what that event is, what its goals are, kind of what your role is at that event. I mean, of course, I was there at the event, standing at a booth, shaking hands, kissing babies, but I'm sure you had a similar role as well, but just an IFS capacity.
Yeah. And this is really our preeminent customer event, Jeff. This is where we have kind of that worldwide user conference, if you will. And this is where we get the opportunity to not only tell customers and prospective customers about how IFS Cloud, the product, and IFS, the company, is progressing, but it's also our ability to showcase partners like yourselves that bring a little extra to that ecosystem where IFS maybe can't provide that functionality or, you know, as what I call kind of a challenger brand at the moment, where we are seeing a lot of interest from IFS, mostly because of our domain experience, but it's really how can we bring partners to the equation to increase that value to prospective customers? And so, you know, much like you sitting at the booth and shaking hands, we had a multitude of partners there as well. But it's really our update to the user community and the partner community around what's going on with the company, what's going on with the product. We've had some acquisitions lately. We're pretty active in that space as well to continue to add to that value. So that's really our preeminent customer event.
In my experience is, I've gone to that event a few years. Like you said, it is worldwide. So we get folks from as far as Australia, New Zealand, all the way to Europe, to Asia, right? Everybody from all over the world comes to those events, both from IFS, but also, like you said, customers, partners, anyone affiliated really with the IFS brand and ecosystem.
Yeah, it really is a big sort of sampling, if you will, from the thousands of customers worldwide. North America is obviously a pretty important region for IFS in that regard. But to your point, we have customers from 80 plus countries that attend because everybody's wanting to understand, right? IFS or ERP software in general, it's the type of software that, you know, those implementations, you want probably a 10, 15, 20 year relationship, right? This is not something that companies want to switch out on a very regular basis. This is more of a long-term, a marriage almost. And so it's important for customers to understand the direction of the company, the direction of the product, what new features are we offering. And these days, everything is AI, right? It's the overhyped topic of the century, if you will, in terms of what it can do.
I want to touch on that point. You talked about that was a long-term relationship. I mean, I know that those conversations I've always, since we've worked with ERP and with engineering software, CAD, like you said, people do not want to change those. It's not like a little SaaS app that you could just buy, use for 6 months or a year and then dump, because their whole business runs on this. And so I remember having conversations with customers who would ask, you know, hey, we like your software. This is CAD Talk perspective. Hey, we like your software. What's your relationship with IFS? You know, are you going to be here tomorrow? And I would always explain yes. And I would explain the relationship and how, you know, we have a partnership, a resellership, and then how we're, you know, continue to expand that and add new integrations, new areas, and closer collaboration, because customers are concerned about, like you said, it's a long-term relationship, not just with IFS, but for their partners as well, like us. You know, will those partners be around and can they depend upon them?
Yeah, I think those are really important points. And, you know, if there's a ding that I sometimes take, it's that, you know, IFS doesn't have thousands of technology partners. And that's true because we do a pretty high level due diligence, right? We want to make sure the partners that we're choosing are going to add the most value to our customers. We don't want to add, let's say, 10 partners in one particular space where, you know, people get challenged for resources. What kind of support can I get? And what's the flavor of the day kind of thing? We're really after those long-term strategic relationships that are going to be value proven. And so we often talk about, you know, as the world moves to this cloud subscription model and it's become much more popular, especially in manufacturing, which, as we know, tends to lag a little bit, right? In terms of the industries and the adoption of technology, they want to make sure the solution is proven. And for us, you know, when we bring a partner to the table, that's really a partner that we value and that we feel we'll stand behind in terms of the value being delivered to our customers. We don't want to have to say, oh, well, that didn't work. Let's swap something else out, right? And go find another one and just kind of continue that, you know, bad chain of events. We want a partner that has the experience that we do in the industry domains that we're in. And that just makes a better experience for everyone all the way around.
It does, because like in this type of relationship, right, IFS is loving their reputation, saying, hey, we vouch for these people, right? We've vetted them. We've gone through that process. And it's almost like introducing you to someone, you know, recommending an employee or anybody, right? You're making the recommendation, and it matters that you want to have your word as IFS to be something that people can depend upon, right? And that they're getting a good partner, a good, whether algae partner or implementation partner.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, for as big as our industry is in the world of software and enterprise software, it's still a small world, right? And so for us, you know, selfishly, I want customers that we can reference as an example of where IFS and partner products have made a difference. And, you know, I've known Scott probably going on, what, 9 years now, I think, maybe longer, Scott.
It should be roughly
that 10-year mark at this point. And I just, you know, CAD Talk is one of those companies that I've worked with just over that 10-year span that I know if you guys are involved, you deliver, right? You're one of the ones that will stand behind what you're selling. And that to me is more important sometimes than the flavor of the day or things like that. And it's not to say we shouldn't keep innovating, right? And you guys do. But I know there's a certain amount of trust there based on the relationship and the work that I've seen done at IFS customers that I know, you know, it's one thing I don't have to worry about when I'm making a recommendation to a customer.
I mean, it's good to know that IFS, because I know not every software company has that same philosophy, right? It's just like whatever the new hotness is or whatever they think is going to help them rather than the long-term relationship where they know you can deliver value. So when you were at, obviously, where I spent a lot of time at the booth and meeting customers and partners, but you obviously had a big part in the events. What were some of the big announcements at IFS Unleashed from IFS itself, you know, and how did customers respond to those?
Yeah. So I think going back to this ever-present AI discussion, right, where our industry, unfortunately, has done a bad job, in my opinion, where AI is pitched as sort of this magic box we open up on the conference room table and it just fixes all the problems. And, you know, one of the real sort of swim lanes of feedback that I kept hearing over and over was from CIOs at customers saying, you know, look, we're under pressure from the board that we've got to deliver something in AI and we're not quite sure what that should be. So I think that was the biggest topic at Unleashed, was really what's IFS's approach here? And I think ours is a little different than some of our competitors because we have launched what we call industrial AI, and it is really AI use cases that are geared towards the industries we serve. So over the last 18 months to 2 years, we spent a tremendous amount of time going to customers to say, where could automation help, right? Where could that analysis help? What can we do in terms of ERP being that general repository of transactional-based data? What can we do to help enable you maybe to become more proactive rather than reactive, right? And so an example of that would be one of the use cases that we got back from a customer early on was, hey, if I have machinery on the production floor and I'm ingesting that sensor data, I would love IFS to analyze that data and tell me proactively, hey, we're noticing maybe that temperature is ticking up 1 degree an hour over the last 6 hours. There's probably something wrong. We should proactively dispatch a technician to check it out rather than wait for that failure, that interruption of productivity or the production line goes down and that causes a whole bunch of other waterfall issues. How can you proactively help us, right, with those data points? And so one of our use cases is really getting much more proactive on the maintenance side to say, hey, we'll analyze that data and we'll not only tell you based on the sensor ingestion that you should dispatch a technician. But by the way, the last 6 times we got this fault code, you should have a technician with this skill set and certifications, but take these 5 spare parts along because we needed those most of the time to resolve it the first time. So we're trying to create that holistic, better experience for everyone involved before an outage occurs. And that's just one of the examples, right? Our other ones are really built around what we call our planning, scheduling, and optimization engine, or PSO. This was an acquisition that IFS made some years ago, and it was really designed to efficiently optimize very large field service teams. So whether they're disparate, you know, taking things like traffic into account, but also the skill sets of those technicians. Where are my spare parts? What can I do? And we've taken that engine, right, those proprietary algorithms and machine learning applicable items, and we've said, let's apply that to manufacturing. So I know that you guys are well familiar with the term MRP, right? Manufacturing resource planning, our materials resource planning. It really hasn't changed in 30 plus years, right? It's just a big calculator that says, oh, what's our demand, supply, and capacity? And here are some recommendations. Our adoption of those PSO algorithms into the manufacturing front now allows us to extend that into applying multiple criteria to that calculator. It's things that are specific to that manufacturer, right? You may be more concerned around optimizing certain machines that are newer versus older, or everything from paint colors to certain technicians. And also have the ability to say, well, look, on this particular routing operation, Scott's 8% more efficient than Jeff is. Well, how does Scott work that makes that better? But wait, we look at the statistics and actually Scott's 8% faster, but we have more quality issues, 12% higher, right, when he does it. So he's working faster, but maybe not better. But it's the ability now to have those data points in a proactive approach to say, look, strategically, IFS is going to alert you to those things that you should focus in on rather than, you know, sitting around. People don't have the free time maybe that they used to, right? Companies are under pressure for efficiencies, and to say, I'm going to go run some feasibility studies, right, on what's going on in these data points. That takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of organization. If IFS contains that data already, lets us, IFS, present it in a better, more strategic way to help with those types of decisions. Lastly, I think part of that PSO engine and those algorithms is the ability to do really advanced what if scenarios. So, you know, a simple one here is I might have a maintenance backlog of 5 weeks. Well, if I use certain subcontractors, I can actually shrink that down to maybe 2 weeks, but obviously I'm going to have some outside costs go up that I wasn't planning on. And how will that really forecast the consuming of my spare parts? So there are a lot of different equations I can throw at the engine without modifying any production data. And I think just the ability for customers to throw those kinds of things to say, what happens if I did this? Or what happens if we tried that without having to make a big production change?
I mean, that's really cool. I mean, I never thought, one of the things you mentioned was how the CIOs came to IFS and said, you know,
help us help ourselves, right? Like help us because we don't know, like AI is a new thing. You're a software technology company. How are we going to use this? And so that's a good way to approach it is to you to bring some of those use cases. And I like the idea of use cases because obviously, you know, AI gets a lot of fanfare, right? It's like the internet. If the internet first came out, well, what can you do with the internet? Well, you can share recipes, right? Some of the initial use cases are a bit thin, but, you know, coming up with real use cases that are beneficial for the customer, you know, it's a good way to come about it. And I guess, you know, IFS is just leveraging the data that they already had, or are you adding areas of like data collection that would add to those algorithms, that AI engine?
We are. And I think, you know, we're also employing a number of partners in this space too, Jeff. So for instance, our focus of that sort of proprietary algorithms and machine learning within PSO and that engine is really key. But also we're leveraging, let's say, Microsoft's investment in OpenAI on the generative side, right? And I think to your point earlier, boardrooms are hearing all of this chatter about ChatGPT and, you know, all these Claude and all of these generative AI engines. And they're saying, how can we use this, right? How can we become more efficient and stay current? And I think it's really a two-pronged approach. You can use generative AI like IFS has started to. We released our first Copilot in May of this year. We had a slew that were released just last week with our 24R2 product release. And these are things ranging from IFS, how do I do XYZ, right? Integrated help and step-by-step walking me through that. But it's going to evolve. You'll see eventually, you know, the ability to say, generate an integration IFS, right? Using RESTful API between this and that, and these are the mappings I want, rather than having to code those things or even use a low-code, no-code tool. They'll be able to generate those kinds of things. For instance, I really expect traditional reporting to finally die. That we've been trying to put a stake through those paper reports forever, right? And I know in implementations I've been involved with in the past, it was like customers come in and say, okay, in this implementation, we need all these reports. This is what I get today. And it's like, all right, when's the last time anyone has actually read these things? And so IFS as a product has moved more to the kind of the dynamic real-time grid displays that customers can sort and group and filter it, but also one-click graph and chart that stuff. But it will extend even beyond that to the point where I can say through the Copilot, you know, hey, give me a recap of this week's sales, which product lines were up, which ones were down, what was my highest grossing customer from a margin perspective. Those types of insights that will become much quicker. We're also leveraging partners like Crosser, where if I look at sort of Industry 4.0 or where manufacturing is going, there's no doubt there needs to be a tighter integration with machines on the plant floor. And we have to make that easy for customers to adopt. And so for us, we thought one of the biggest stumbling blocks is, you know, there's different PLC languages. There's Rockwell, there's Allen Bradley, part of Rockwell, there's Bosch. How do we make it easy for customers to connect to that machine level data? And that data is very noisy. So how do we put a tool in our product to help filter that down to say that machine may spit out 100 different data points and metrics, but the customer really only cares about three, right? Like, how do we filter that out? And then more importantly, we couple that with something like our business process automation tool that says, hey, IFS, these are the three data points I want, and these are the tolerances. This is normal. This is not normal, right? This is an anomaly or outside the range. But then we tell it, if you see that, here's what I want you to do. Here's the workflow I want you to kick off. So it's that ability to sort of embed that automation in there. And we are very interested in partners that can help sort of bring that sort of innovation mindset to the product. I know that, you know, if I take CADTalk as an example where we started originally with manufacturing bombs, right? That's where I viewed CADTalk as the highest value leader in helping to coordinate that through the transformation engine. But let's take that a step further, right? Let's look at model data for assets, not just, let's say, how it was designed, but oftentimes when our customers are sort of designing, installing these complex assets, there's either some changes that happen in manufacturing. There could be some changes in installation at the field site that says, oh, wait, we can't use that. We have to use this. Technicians that go out to service those assets after the fact, they really need those different stops to say, well, this is how it was designed. This is how it was manufactured. This is how it was installed. And this is how it's serviced, right? The ability to see those different phases. And I view CAD partner or CAD talk as somewhat strategic there, right? To help us say, how can we extend that model data all the way through that life cycle rather than just keeping it in the manufacturing space?
Yeah, it's interesting. I know you and I have had a lot of conversations about assets. It's not a traditional place that we've seen, but it makes a lot of sense because it's the same kind of structure, same data structure, same need is there for those companies that have those assets. Because I know we've worked with customers who, like, they install plants or some sort of, like, I think about, like, even in agriculture, right? They may design, manufacture, and then ship to the site, you know, the parts, and then build this whole unit of a thing, right? And then they have to maintenance that over time. And that may require new designs, you know, changes there that have to be backward compatible and then have to be installed or retrofitted on site. And so all of that matters.
Yeah. And if I think, Jeff, like another partner that we work with is sort of this augmented reality for service technicians, right? Where they're saying, maybe I'm a little newer, I'm out in the field, but I know somebody back in the office is super experienced. You know, I can share, just like I would a FaceTime call, I can share that asset that I'm working on. But what if I had the ability to overlay that CAD model and pick out spare parts just by, you know, selecting them and automatically adding them into a purchase requisition or maybe to an order for a customer? You know, that interactiveness to look through that model and say, oh, this is what's bad, and IFS highlight that for me, and I can one click, you know, order that spare part or check on a map to see maybe I don't have the spare part, but some supply chain partner that we work with does have it and it's less than 3 miles away. How fast can I get it? Right. So it's that ability to kind of see that all the way through that asset life cycle to determine that, because I've seen a lot of interest, you know, I can look through a manual, but if I don't have to carry that thing around, if I don't have to reference it, if I can get some interactive ability to kind of model that thing and move it around and say, yeah, it's these parts right here or this assembly right here. And then if I have the integrated manufacturing notes of what happened and all of that stuff, it completely changes what we can offer from a service perspective.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I know that we always talked about was from integration standpoint, but most of the manufacturing is starting from engineering all the way to the end, right? All the way to the out the door. So how can we provide more value from the design inception all the way, you know, into the ERP, but beyond, you know, from a labor tracking, from raw material consumption, all the way to the shipping to handle all of that. This is just one more extension beyond that, right? Which is going all the way to the dock, the shop floor, but now that's now out to the field, right? And then just the next logical step.
Yeah, right. You know, quite candidly, that's been one of IFS's biggest differentiators over the last few years is that, you know, we have this manufacturing and traditional ERP supply chain field service asset maintenance that's all in a single code base of our platform. So where I've seen us add a tremendous amount of value is with companies that start out looking for ERP manufacturing software and say, oh yeah, we're going to need service, but that's going to be a separate RFP because we know we can't get it all in the same software. And it's a timeout. You can. And that's where we have made a big difference in terms of the customers that we're servicing, because they're starting to see that complete picture, right? And they might not have all the pieces today. It's a different mindset to start thinking that, you know, the designers can flow that work that they do goes all the way to the service team. And then by the way, back, right? That bi-directional feedback is important, because if I'm a technician in the field, I could say, oh, I can see why this fails. It was installed this way, or it was put in this environment that doesn't work. And maybe the engineers didn't think about that. So it's also the ability to funnel that back to the designers to say, maybe we need a rev change, right? Maybe there needs to be some modification to make this better and to continually evolve it. And I think, you know, as if I look at our competitors, some have different components of that, but not sort of market leading in all those spaces across the board. And that's really what has kind of shown through, if you will, over the last 2 to 3 years.
I was just thinking about that example you were using earlier. Like when I used to be in manufacturing, we used to make packaging machinery, and they'd have these parts books that were like all the drawings of everything that we had to. You know, and then there's a lot of service on the machines, like chains would go down and things like that. And you had to go through like a 500 page like drawing manual to figure out what part it was that you were servicing. And then we actually looked at this back, honestly, even 20 years ago, having the solid model, you could disassemble it in virtual space and just say, I want two of these things. I want two of these parts for service. And it was just like, it was such a mind bender even thinking about doing that at that time, because the technology just wasn't there yet. But it was, because I remember like the worst case scenario, this is kind of a funny side story, is that they would literally, sometimes the machines were so old, they would send technicians out with like, and there was no drawings for it. They would pull a gear off the machine and then stencil it on a piece of paper and then send it back to their machine shop to make it from the stencil, because they had no idea what the part was in order to service the machine. And that's really old school there. But like, it just kind of shows you how much faster you can move with the right technology. And it's all tied together.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if we extend that now, like, you know, and ferro arms have been around for a while too, right? There's the ability to 3D scan that part. But we see the advent of things like additive manufacturing, right? Where I'm 3D printing certain parts, and, you know, across the board, whether it's manufacturing, aerospace, et cetera, but the ability to kind of turnkey create that thing as needed. And I know I've seen plenty of customers where the communication's not clear. So engineering may have bumped a rev and manufacturing doesn't even know about it. They're still making the old rev. You know, they've just built hundreds or thousands of products and they go, oh my God, we got to scrap this because we missed this rev bump, right? And that's where I see this beginning, because CAD Talk's right at the early stages of this, right? It's either it's a prototype, it's a design element within engineering, and engineering shouldn't have to worry that what they're designing is making its way to the ERP product, right? And, you know, thankfully, the days of hand keying that stuff or even Excel imports and exports, it's like, you know, I just don't have to worry about it. And I think as service becomes more important, you know, as the world changes in terms of uptime and availability and speed to value, you know, having the right information at every one of those audience points along that trail is just crucial now.
I know recently I was working with a recent customer that's in the racing industry. And then, of course, in racing, right, it's all how important it is to prototyping and getting it out there. And how I think one of the conversations was about dwell time. Like, how long from the time that it's released from engineering can we get it over here and done? And they want to measure that so they can get that, you know, lower. So that the dwell time from, okay, I hit release to it's live here, what is that? Because in that industry, right, time is critical, right? Because it's all about speed. So I know we were talking, some of those conversations I was having with that integration came up, you know, can we see the dwell time? And of course we can between the two systems. You know, CAD Talk has access to both. And I know what one is released and I know when it was created in IFS. And so we can then measure in a report, right, what was that time?
Yeah. And I think, you know, with the advent of being able to train what I would call video or visual models, right, of here's what's good and here's what's bad. And so even quality as a bottleneck at some point, right? I might have made all these things, but we do need to do samplings or provide certain certifications to our customers. You know, is this product within spec? And I've seen this being adopted quite a bunch over the last year and a multitude of customers, whether it's food, like I have one that's measuring, you know, cookies or dog biscuits. And if it's broken, you know, the arm comes out and sweeps it right off the line and it doesn't make it to packaging. But, you know, there's camera and models now that we're training it. This is what looks good and this is what's bad. And so I think, you know, as part of that dwell that you're mentioning, it's just that ability to move things through faster, right? Especially if you're trying to prototype new parts, or, you know, you might be trying to get a leg up on competition in certain areas. You have to continuously find opportunities that are going to provide, you know, a better speed to value with that high quality that's still demanded.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that we talk to you about. Your point is about speed, right? Is that we, you know, talk about in these CAD talks of lead time, which is the same thing, right? How fast can I get from idea or ideation, design, all the way to the customer and realize that value timeline and then speed that up, right? How can we make that as fast as possible with, you know, not degrading in quality? And all of these systems are important to be able to do that. Otherwise, like, no way to do that manually, right? There's no way to get that speed.
Yeah. And I think we'll continue to see this evolve at sort of a breakneck pace. But I think we're finally starting to get to a certain level of maturity with AI. Like, for instance, I think at Unleashed, we launched about 32 use cases that were really sort of vetted by our customer base. And we have things called customer advisory boards. And these are extremely active customers within different target markets that, IFS serves to give us the feedback of what will help and, you know, what will truly change the game in terms of adding value. And I think getting that feedback has been crucial for us to develop these use cases and also to come to market with, you know, our domain expertise and that industry background to say, look, this is what we know is initially going to help. And as a publisher, we have to package that in an easily consumable way, right? We can't make the AI so confusing to end users that, you know, this is too cumbersome or it hallucinates too much. It doesn't bring that back. And I think the other aspect to this is sort of the data privacy, right? Everyone wants to understand if I am using, let's even say a Gen AI copilot, is that model learning from my data, right? I don't want that going public where my competitor can just go to ChatGPT and ask, you know, how are they making this product or what kind of quality statistics do they have? So for IFS, that AI component is all contained within the customer's instance. So in fact, IFS, we don't even have access to that data or what we call the customer content, unless they would be sharing a screen for a tech support case, right? We take that very seriously. And I think that that's important because that's a strong concern for customers to say, like, hey, I'm going to put a lot of this into the data pool here. And I don't want to share that with anyone outside the walls, right? And how can we make sure that doesn't happen? So you have to have the data governance in place. You have to make sure that data is good. And I think this is back to our earlier conversation, Jeff. If we can start at the design phase and that's waterfalling all the way down and it's correct and it's up to date and the revisions are active, et cetera, bad data begets really bad analysis. And so a lot of these customers that come will say, hey, if you have, you know, data that you have these sort of years compiled, we'll take it. We can use that in some of our even demand planning algorithms, right? But that data has to be good and it has to be governed, right?
Well, in the world of AI, I mean, the data is the asset. I mean, that's really, that gives the context for it to make its decisions and everything else. So it's like, I think you get more and more where everybody is becoming, you know, a data company. That's their competitive advantage is their experience. And if they've put that in a machine readable format, then the AI becomes more leverageable every day. So like,
I think, you know, I have an interesting customer story. I won't say the name, but it's a rather large sort of pest control and rodent company, which normally you wouldn't think, it's not the sexiest of examples, right? But they came to us 3 or 4 years ago and said, hey, we fundamentally changed the way we provide this service to our customers. And so traditionally, these businesses operate on what we would refer to as somewhat of a milk run, right? Every Monday, I go to this route, a Tuesday, I go to that route, and then I just kind of repeat that after a certain number of weeks. Well, they wanted to put these little sensors in the bait boxes, in the traps, in other areas of their things. So then they were able to shift to a subscription model to say, we only need to dispatch someone when we detect an issue. Either the bait's gone, maybe it got wet, maybe there was a vibration that tripped the trap. Now we're really adding value when we go out there rather than just, hey, I'm showing up on Monday, it's my day, do you need anything, right? But to me, the most interesting aspect of that project was kind of to Scott's point, they have the data points to say, well, Scott, I know you have the 4 buildings on this particular plant, right? And I can tell that between the weeks of September 18th and October 12th, that's where we see the influx of field mice trying to get into these 2 back doors of building 3. We're going to put some extra traps back there. And we know from the data models that that's peaking at that time during the year. So they're able to offer either additional or enhanced levels of service purely based on the data that's coming through, right? And to me, that's the more interesting aspect of that product or that project. It's cool that sensors are now in all those machines and stuff. But to me, it's like, man, you have crazy amounts of data that give you way more insight in terms of how to better manage that.
Oh, yeah. And that data actually provides that customer a competitive advantage over someone who doesn't have the data. So like the data becomes the product at that point, is that they can offer, they can use that data to offer a more granular service or a more service that's more fine-tuned to the customer's needs, which is, you know, essentially a different product at that point. So it's actually, yeah.
Yeah. To your point, Scott, we could take that example and we can now apply it, you know, to other examples. So for instance, maybe we have a food and beverage customer that is storing ingredients in certain silos or maybe even tractor trailers, right? And there could be a host of environmental factors there. Maybe it gets too hot and it's prematurely causing spoilage of the raw material before it makes it to the line. So, you know, we could put sensors in there. We could put automatic fans in there for circulation or cool down or different things like that. But I think to your point, you know, CIOs especially are getting such pressure from these ports to say, we want to see some kind of a concrete example on return here for us to do projects like this. And that's on us, right? That's on us to help prove that story out and to help model that in value returns and other scenarios. We have the tools to do that now, which is exciting.
I think it's like everybody thinks about like the better tooling or AI is something that like, I mean, everybody thinks first the cost savings is the easier use cases come up with. Well, but the ones that are really exciting is when it actually can fundamentally improve your business and the products you sell. I mean, that's the other, like that company, just the pest control. I mean, they're actually like kind of going back. It's like not only are they saving the cost of the customer, but they're actually enhancing the service, enhancing the product using the technology, using the data. And that's like where you start getting, you know, exponential growth, you know, from your, because that's what people, the demand goes way up for you.
Yeah, I mean, it gives them the ability to completely kind of refocus on how the company provides that service or that product to their end user. And, you know, we're seeing this with even assets that are deployed in the field. It's like we have the ability now to get that feedback. Now, we want to make sure we do it in a secure way. We want to make sure that it's private or limited to just the scope of what we're after. But we have such potential now to carry that all the way through to give those insights back to business. And it's really, IFS takes that as a bit of an obligation to provide that, where we can, you know, hopefully play well with others and bring in partners to say, look, here's where we're really good, right? We're going to provide that level of engagement with you to help think about those things that you might not normally might have thought about in terms of an AI project.
One of the things I was thinking about when you were mentioning that pest control, I thought the same thing for like, I like for a better word, horticulture, or like I originally thought of like your yard, right? The same guy comes out every week and sprays your yard or waters it or whatever. You have a sprinkler system, all because you don't, it's just a, you know, a thing, right? So you might waste a lot of water. You see that, especially like at Disney World or wherever, these huge places, right? Where they have to use probably millions of gallons of water keeping this, but you could use that same sort of sensor system, that same sort of algorithm, the AI, to figure out like, you know, what's the, you know, the fertilizer content of the soil? What's the water moisture? How often do I need to water this?
Yeah. And I think, you know, Jeff, that IFS is quite active in utilities, right? Not only because of our recent acquisition of Copperleaf, but IFS in that strategic asset management portfolio. If we look at utility companies, you know, one of the things I found interesting and part of the folks on my team, they come from industry. So they're there to provide sort of that industry focus on how IFS can service that industry better. And one of the folks on our team has a tremendous amount of experience and background with utilities. And he's run through some scenarios recently where a lot of utilities are starting to deploy drones for what they call vegetation control or veg control, meaning, you know, we would see in the past, you know, certain helicopters with saws hanging down that are helping to keep things off the lines. But it's really has the potential to save that utility millions of dollars. So if you think of maybe a storm coming through, IFS now has the ability to look at weather forecast 10 days out to help model maybe some service interruptions, or maybe we should better position crews here. We should have mutual standby on, you know, mutual aid on standby or certain spare parts position certain places. But these utilities are now utilizing these drones to go out and say, we're going to, you know, very pointedly send the drone out to do some vegetation control. The other area we see this in utilities is that if some bad weather or maybe even let's say a wildfire, God forbid, comes through and they have to power those lines down to make sure that they're not going to contribute to some catastrophic event, it takes a lot of time. Those lines need visually inspected before they can be powered back up. But if I can deploy a drone based on certain data points of where that weather went through, and that drone has the cameras to do those visual inspections, again, of what's good, what's bad, just, you know, again, back to that speed of service and speed of value, it just provides tremendous opportunities for our customers to take advantage of some of these use cases.
Yeah, that's, it's incredible. I mean, I think about all the use cases that you're talking about, all the use cases you could have for service industry and really large critical infrastructure, right? Like you said, the problem is simple, like vegetation. The problem is simple, but the problem to understand is simple, but it's not an easy problem, right? Because you have all those areas. And then used to be, you had to physically go out there and have somebody look. I think about like we have Duke here locally and they come by and with a truck, right? They're just in the residential area, right? You have to come by and they cut off the trees or whatever to make sure that like it's preemptive. But with those drones, that technology, be able to map even all the areas that would be at risk.
And some utilities are deploying cameras on utility poles now to say if there is some event or weather that goes through, you know, have the camera pinpoint an alarm to say, oh, notice this line's down or we had some service interruption here, you know, because it used to be, right, we would have to call that utility and say, hey, I don't have any power, right? I'm down. And then you'd get sort of this big window of time as to when it was projected to be back on. But I think with the advent of the sensors and more importantly, you know, to Scott's point, the data is the asset now, right? That's really what turns it. And software providers have to play well with others. We have to be a platform that's ready to ingest that data, analyze that data, and then more importantly, either provide what-if scenarios or real-world capabilities to dispatch to get those things fixed and serviced. And that is applicable to a utility like we just discussed, but equally so to a manufacturer that's running a 24/7 operation with different production lines where they can't afford for a machine or a component to break and cause an outage and a delay. And then all of a sudden I have a 4-week backlog that I got to get through. And, you know, those are all things that good software will help solve.
Well, I want to kind of wrap it up and kind of get back to manufacturing a little bit. Now, I've talked to a lot of manufacturers over the last 10 years. I've been at CAD Talk and a lot of ones with IFS and your new customers. And what is your advice to, and you said it yourself, I'll get back to like manufacturing tends to be a bit slower on the uptake of technology, right? A little more conservative for adopting new technology, adopting the cloud, adopting or changing the ERPs, which they need to do. In my experience, a lot of the ERPs, the top manufacturing companies we see are really on old legacy systems, right? Sometimes mainframe green screen still. Hard to believe, but some of them are still running that those systems. What is your advice for those manufacturing companies that are still, you know, maybe considering ERP or considering changes? You know, how do they navigate, know that they are slow to adopt? And typically those manufacturing companies are also, you know, community built. What's your advice for them? How do they go about modernizing their systems? How do they do that?
Well, you know, these projects can be scary, right? Because folks like us, we encounter dozens of implementations at any given point in time, right? We know sort of the stress that entails. And I will say that anyone in a company that is looking to do these projects, they will end up with a mini MBA on that company by the end of the project, right? They're going to learn things they never imagined about the company. And, you know, oftentimes we hear, let's say from a steering committee or executives, this is how we do it. And then you find someone on the floor and they're like, we don't do it at all. And there's that iteration. But I think to your point, right now, there's so much noise and so much hype on certain topics. At the end of the day, there has been a certain level of maturity here that you can find the experience to say, how can I do this? I had a difficult discussion with a prospective customer recently, and they were really after the holy grail of optimizing their production schedule. And we know, being in this for 20 plus years, that, you know, that's almost the end point, right? You have to have a million things exactly right and perfect until you can get to that ideal scheduling model. And I said to them candidly, I think you're biting off too much trying to do scheduling plus ERP. Like, you have to kind of get that foundation done. And so these projects tend to get scope creep, right? All of a sudden, they see so many options of efficiencies and gains that, you know, they become like squirrels and shiny objects. And it's tough. You have to stay focused on the outcome that you're trying to get done in that first phase, because if you can get over that initial big hump, and it is a lot of work, I don't want to pretend that it's easy to do these things, but there are enough peer groups out there, and this is applicable really to any business that you're involved with. There are peer groups that can really help you. There's people that have been through this that you can talk to sort of in an unbiased way to just say, look, this is what we're thinking about. What would you recommend? And here in the US, it's somewhat unique that there's a whole industry of selection consultants, right, that are there to sort of document how you do things and say best practices. These are the software providers you should look at. But you can, you know, even through generative AI, I can find out in most cases what ERP a company or a competitor is using. And so oftentimes it's good to learn sort of what are other people in that industry doing? What have they done, right? What are the lessons learned? And I think it's even mediums like this through podcasts that, you know, you listen to other people's experiences on what worked and what didn't. But I will say that, you know, from my perspective, these projects are challenging, but if you can kind of stay focused on that initial outcome to get the ERP installed, get that foundation of good data flowing, the other things that you want to add in the future will come at a much less steep curve, is the way to put that, because, you know, you've already adopted sort of the general flows and understandings of how the system works. So to add additional functionality will come much more quickly. There are other counter arguments to that, though, right? That say, hey, we do this once and then every phase two never happens, right? But part of this is continuously seeking out that continuous improvement, right? How can we get better now that we have this? And so that initial foundation to get done, either the software provider, a valued partner, some they'll help you get through that initial phase. I think I'm on about 8 steering committees right now with recent wins of new IFS customers, but it's important to me to understand what hiccups they encounter, right? Because every one of those is a learning exercise. What maybe didn't we communicate right? Where were the gaps that we should have probably helped out? And I can get, you know, jump in and fix something quickly rather than it festering and you know, that communication just dies. So in these types of projects, communications and expectations are the two biggest things for what we want for success.
Now, you hit on two kind of key things for me, at least, was one was that these projects, we talk about it in our values. It's like, you should see it not as an event. Like implementation is not an event. It's a process, right? It's like anything else, right? You lift weights every day to get stronger, right? It's a process. You don't one day just do this, you know, 3-hour workout and get really strong. It's a process, right? You're developing that muscle of that process, that continuous improvement process. Trying to instill that anytime that we start CAD Talk projects, it's like, look, you know, we can do a lot, but we should really, to your point, deliver that value and then think about it as how do you develop that culture of continuous improvement?
Yeah, it's a mind shift, right? And to your point, it is a culture change because I think, you know, from a negative perspective, our industry used to treat go lives as the goal. Like, hey, we went live. Thank you very much. We're on. And I think with the advent of sort of SaaS models and subscriptions, the publishers, the IFS included, we need to do that better job, right? We have to have that higher level of intimacy because we talked earlier about no company wants to have to do this, you know, more frequently than
ever again.
Right, exactly. I mean, honestly, some people are really lucky to go through one of these. There are rare exceptions where you might go through 2 or 3 in your career, but, you know, these are big projects and they're cumbersome. So companies don't want to have that disruption, right, of going through it more often than they have to. So I think to your point, that culture shift just to be able to think differently will be super beneficial because I think even now in some of our service offerings to customers, we're looking to how do we stay close beyond the go live, right? We want to understand what are those long-term strategic goals of the company and the customer to make sure IFS's roadmap fits into some of those strategic initiatives so that, you know, when they call us, let's say in 2 years and we say, wait, who are you and how are you using the software? And I mean, that's just bad experience for everyone, right? So if we can create that higher level of intimacy, and that's why I'm happy to serve on steering committees because, you know, it might be a half hour here or there during the week. And there might be 8 of them and that's okay because if I can help to resolve some of those things more quickly and get to that, you know, go live and beyond, that's really what we're after.
Yeah, could have said it better myself. So Kevin, we're coming close to an hour. It's been an amazing conversation. I just kind of want to wrap up, you know, where can, you know, people who, you know, they listen to this podcast, are interested in IFS manufacturing companies, how can they learn more about IFS or you yourself, or, you know, how do they get in touch, that sort of thing?
Yeah. So I'm pretty open on LinkedIn. I share everything from, you know, company and software updates to just, you know, general things that I see in the field, customer products, right? That's always the most interesting aspect to me. And I think, like you guys, if we do a 1 hour plant tour, we can learn more about that operation than six meetings, right? So I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. We do have links on YouTube for the product. We also have video libraries of every aspect of not just IFS, but some partner products as well. CAD Talks in that library. If customers want to understand, how does it work? How do I want to see it? What does it do? Right? Kind of that introduction. So we have a wide variety of media that way that they can get engaged, but LinkedIn's probably the quickest one. But yeah, and I typically respond to every inquiry that I get.
Well, Kevin, this has been a great conversation. I really appreciate you giving us that hour. I guess the next time you and I will be together will probably be in the UK at an IFS event. That's usually when we see each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Just probably less than a month away at this point.
That's about right. Yeah, that's about right.
Awesome.
Well, Kevin, anything else before we let you go? And I appreciate you spending an hour with us.
No, I really appreciate the partnership. Again, there's been a tremendous amount of value added through this relationship, and we want to keep it going, and really appreciate your support along the way, the support that you provide IFS customers as well. And my pleasure to be here today.
Okay. Well, thank you, Kevin. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Please subscribe, make a comment, you know, reach out to Kevin or on LinkedIn. So thanks very much. We'll see you next time.
Awesome. All right. Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Integrate Intelligently podcast from CAD Talk Software. Don't forget to subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss future episodes. Video versions of the podcast will be available on CAD Talk's YouTube page, linked in the show notes. The Integrate Intelligently podcast is hosted by CAD Talk CEO Scott Brickler and CRO Jeff Brickler. Our producer is myself, marketing manager John Thomas. If you have a story you want to share on the podcast or you want to partner with us, let us know. Email marketing@cadtalk.com and be sure to mention podcast in the subject line.